I just have to start by saying a little about climate change science, because it obviously is the backdrop to all the issues we're currently facing. I should say I'm not a scientist, I'm a social scientist. Therefore, I read the literature, as it were, externally, but I have spent some 2 years immersed in it. Just briefly put, there are three positions on climate change and what its consequences are for us. And these have very considerable political resonance, all of them. First of all, there is the view of the climate change skeptics, now sometimes called climate change contrarians, the people who've got enormous publicity around the Copenhagen meetings. One of the perverse effects of Copenhagen was that the skeptics, as it were, produced their own global mobilization around this, and everyone, I'm sure, will have been following this in the newspapers. The skeptics say either that climate change is not happening, global warming is not happening, climate change and global warming being the same, or else they say that it's not produced by human activity, but is the result of natural events, either associated with the movements of the sun or phenomena happening on the sun or other natural phenomena, rather than being produced by greenhouse gases and the familiar causation, which is the view of most people in orthodox climate change science. Things to note about the climate change skeptics: most of them are not themselves scientists, although a few are. A good example is a person who I've crossed swords with quite often in the House of Lords, the former Chancellor of Exchequer, Nigel Lawson, who I believe is a product of this university, and a very distinguished person. The book he wrote, I think, has had a considerable impact on public opinion. It's worth checking out. Can I tell you the reason? The reason is that one shouldn't be simply naively, someone who like me, who thinks that climate change is real and dangerous for reasons I'll mention, extremely dangerous, should, however, engage with the skeptics, because skepticism, after all, is the motor of scientific activity. The difference between being a scientist, whether you're a natural scientist or a social scientist, and dogma is that you're prepared to revise your beliefs constantly in the light of incoming knowledge. Therefore, what we should really want is a dialogue between the skeptics and the wider scientific and public communities. We don't really have that dialogue. What's coming is something I think quite dysfunctional, which is like a kind of radical division with emotional hostility on both sides. We need to try to avoid that, and we can discuss afterwards, if anyone's interested, how we might do so. Anyway, the climate change skeptics probably only represent, something like maybe 5% of the world's climate scientists, but they have a massive effect upon public opinion. So the political resonance of the climate change skeptics is very, very large. I do want to come back to that, because it is a very, very important aspect of the politics of climate change and where we go from now, post-Copenhagen. So that's one group. The second group is, as it were, the broad body of scientific opinion, represented by something I'm sure everyone here will know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the United Nations, the IPCC. The IPCC has collected together the work of hundreds of climate scientists across the world over the past few years and produced a series of authoritative volumes on the causation and the likely consequences of climate change. They were supposed to produce with the authority of the United Nations, since this is an agency of the United Nations. What is the IPCC's view? Well, it is that climate change is indeed caused by greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere, that you can chart this over the beginning of the period since the origins of industrial civilization about 150 years ago, that its consequences are indeed very dangerous, especially if we don't take action to remedy it. But on the whole, the IPCC tends to see the risks and the dangers associated with climate change as some way down the line, tends to see them as likely to be particularly acute towards mid-century or later. Sees the risks as very, very dangerous for us, but nevertheless, on the whole, doesn't tend to see them as imminent. I mean, the IPCC, like the majority of scientists, argues that a 2% rise in global average temperature is probably inevitable. But beyond that, tends to see, in a range of scenarios which it presents, a whole spectrum of risks, but as it were, some way off. However, there is a third group, and this group, to my mind, is important. And these, unlike the skeptics, these are scientists, and I call them the radicals. They say that climate change is more dangerous, is more proximate, is closer at hand, and could move much more rapidly than the IPCC-style approach says. So you could say that the while the skeptics say we've exaggerated the risks of climate change and see the IPCC as a kind of almost a conspiracy against the global public by scaring people, for the radicals, the IPCC is essentially a conservative organization because it has to assimilate the views of many, many scientists and reach a common position, which the radicals see as a kind of midway position. A good example of a radical view of climate change is the American NASA scientist James Hansen, who you may have come across in the newspapers, who argues, like other radicals do, that the dangers offered by climate change are not simply remote ones. We're already, rather like James Lovelock as well, we're already deeply involved in a world which is extremely threatening to us. It's not something just in the distant future. And the radicals tend to say that climate change can happen in a concentrated fashion within a very short period of time. You may have heard about the famous tipping points in climate change. In the past, you know, through the geological record, we know that climate change has happened sometimes very, very quickly. Sometimes within a period of 10 years, short period like that, you've got a major change in average global temperatures. The radicals say this could happen now, and they distinguish four or five major tipping points in the world. If you look in, for example, eastern Siberia in Russia, there are peat bogs across that area, to some extent in Canada. They've been there for possibly hundreds of millions of years, permafrost. The peat bogs are now melting. If they do melt, there are tons and tons in the TONNES designation of methane buried underneath the, well, as the peat bogs are no longer frozen, they release methane into the air. Methane is a greenhouse gas which is reckoned to be something like 18 times as potent as CO2, the sort of core greenhouse gas in most people's thinking. So according to Hansen and people on the radical side of things, you could have devastating climate change within relatively near future and happening quite suddenly. Now, you know, you have fantastic difficulty in assessing climate change because there are very few people who are climate scientists. Even other scientists don't necessarily specialize in the climate as such. But in my assessment of looking at these three positions, certainly seems to me that the radicals have as much chance of being correct as the skeptics, and that therefore one must conclude, pending, of course, always the possibility of further findings, that climate change is a terrifying possibility for our future, that if we don't take action to arrest it, its consequences could be devastating. And, you know, I just ask you to think about that. Well, I'm sure the fact that you're here means that you are thinking about it very seriously, but, you know, it's an awesome fact to think that we may be on the verge of intervening in the world's climate and in a permanent way, because the greenhouse gases, once they're in the atmosphere, are likely to stay there for centuries. We don't know of any way of getting them out of there on a large scale. To permanently change the world's climate is a devastating thing. And as, again, I'm sure most people here will know, one of the major consequences of climate change is much more violent and extreme weather patterns across the Earth. And you only have to look at naturally occurring phenomena to see just how dangerous that could be. I mean, you know, think of what's been happening in Haiti. Haiti has nothing to do with climate change, but I think it does remind us of the awesome power of nature. And it reminds us what could happen if we don't take action. And, you know, I think if you want a metaphor for this, you know, there's a sort of well-known ancient joke of someone who jumps out of a skyscraper and every window on every floor on the way down, people hear him saying, "So far, so good, so far, so good, so far, so good." That could be us. That could be a metaphor for our future. And I ask you to reflect on, you know, the statistics of it. If you jump off a skyscraper, you maybe got something like a 5% chance of landing on an awning, let's say, and being saved. But only if you wanted to commit suicide would you jump, when those were the odds. Well, those seem to be about the odds for climate change. That is, as well over 90% certainty that climate change is produced by greenhouse gases and that it does hold out extreme dangers for us. So therefore, in my view, we must act. You can't trade the future of humanity against such odds. It doesn't make any sense. Therefore, we must act. Well, the world community, of course, has got together, or we thought it was getting together, because Copenhagen meetings just happened. I was there in the first part of those meetings, although I didn't stay for the sort of nitty-gritty of the negotiations. And anyone interested in the politics of climate change has to ask what happened there and why. Well, I don't want to dwell on it at enormous length because there's a lot more that I'd like to discuss with you. But my view on Copenhagen I can sketch out fairly briefly. I'm not one of those who was devastated by what happened at Copenhagen, because, as I argue in the aforesaid book, I never thought that Kyoto Copenhagen style approach was going to be successful. It seemed to me there's never much chance of getting 192 nations together to agree on policies of the kind of policies with bite that we must have if we're going to confront the issue of climate change. Moreover, if you look back at Kyoto, it had supposedly binding, it was a binding treaty in international law, but actually plenty of the countries that signed up to Kyoto simply ignored it. As we know, the United States did not sign up, but those who did sign up, a whole cluster of them are nowhere near meeting their Kyoto targets if you factor out the impact of recession and you go to the year 2007. A whole cluster of industrial countries nowhere near meeting their Kyoto targets. And, Kyoto was a valuable exercise in global consciousness, and in a certain way Copenhagen was. But I think most students of the subject are agreed that the Kyoto Protocol did not significantly reduce greenhouse gases. And over that period, greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere rose steeply and continued to do so until the period of recession, which because of the cutback industrial activity has reduced emissions by something like 9%. But it's only a temporary thing. So I always thought that an alternative approach to Copenhagen would be needed. I think you also have to see, and I think everyone should take an interest in this, in terms of the international politics of climate change. Copenhagen should not be seen as a singular event. Copenhagen was an expression of the divisions which fracture the world community. Copenhagen expressed the state of the world in which we live, in which we're much more interdependent than we ever were before, climate change being the negative aspect of that interdependence, but where we simply don't have the instruments of global governance to directly cope with that through full transnational consensus. So what did Copenhagen show? First of all, the weakness of the United Nations. The United Nations, quite good at promoting causes, poor at taking decisions because it's crippled by internal divisions between the nations that compose it. Second, massive division between the developed countries and the developing world, which went through the whole of Copenhagen meetings. Third, very worrying for us living in Europe, the sidelining of the EU, which was not involved in the final negotiations led by President Obama and the Chinese at all. I don't know how far you do follow all this, but this is really significant because the EU aspires to be the global leader in climate change policy. There it was ignored in Copenhagen. Why? Well, because no one speaks for the EU, because the EU has four or five leaders minimum. And it expresses the more general structural problems of the EU. Fourthly, Copenhagen expressed the dominance of domestic over international politics, nowhere more acutely than in the United States, because President Obama was unable to get climate change bill through the Congress. And I'll come back to this in a minute, so it's very, very important, because the Republicans mobilized against all of Obama's policies, including healthcare. Obama came to Copenhagen with nothing to offer, really. Nothing significant to offer in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Not surprising, therefore, that the Chinese took the attitude they did. And my final point would be, the issue of China and India, now much more important in decision-making processes, much more important than they were even 5 years ago. But certainly in the case of China, I'm not sure how far China has really mobilized to accept the multilateral nature of international relations, which is a certain condition, I think, for coping with climate change. China still wants to behave rather like a sovereign state, in a traditional notion of sovereignty, when it's obvious that climate change makes traditional sovereignty obsolete. So, we face a whole package of problems there. What came out of Copenhagen was the Copenhagen Accord, signed at the last minute by a small group of nations, now called the Basic Group, because if you look at the nations who compose that group, it spells BASIC. I won't go through them, but they include, crucially, the United States, Brazil, India, and China, along with South Africa. That's the BASIC group. What are we to make of the Copenhagen Accord? Well, I think time will tell, but I think there is at least the possibility that it is a beginning which could be more effective than Kyoto-style processes. We don't know, because we don't know how it will evolve. What are the advantages of the accord? Well, you've got the big developing countries working directly with the industrial countries in the accord. Brazil, China and India are working with the United States and will have to be the European Union. And that's an advance, because it was the fracture between the developed and developing world which helped to undermine Copenhagen and made it the fiasco that it was. Second, having a smaller group of nations means that you can, in principle, move more quickly, certainly than you could with 192 nations. The accord will be driven by a smaller number of nations. Third, all the main polluters are in there. Only a handful of countries, something like between 6 to 8 countries, produce over 80% of total global greenhouse gases. It is obvious to me that they should work together. Even if you had, like, 180 countries agreeing in Copenhagen, it had all worked out. If you didn't have the main polluters in there, you're not getting anywhere anyway. So there is at least the possibility that the accord may produce more systematic action, or it may collapse. I mean, absolutely nobody knows at the moment. It's certainly not a satisfactory outcome, because it was a last-minute agreement. My view is that we should have been working for several years with the main polluters working together, with the United States and China working together, because they produce well over 40% of total global emissions between them. That it's much more effective to work with the texture of international relations rather than on the basis of some fictional agreement which has no real content. So I think we have an obligation, the British government and the governments of other industrial countries, to try to develop the accord. We have to try to, and at some point, we would have to create some kind of treaty mechanism out of it. It's no good it just being a series of voluntary agreements, I think. It would have to have some kind of treaty structure. We'll see, by the time the discussions move to Mexico at the end of the year, how much progress has been made. However, that's not the main part of my argument. The main part of the argument I want to propose to you is that we have to get on with it. We have an obligation in the industrial countries to radically reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases in the short order. Whatever is agreed in the accord, the industrial countries must be in the lead. They have an historic responsibility, because these are the countries that have put most of the greenhouse gas emissions in the air in the first place. Therefore, national policy is going to count for quite a lot. And we have to ask what a politics of climate change should now look like post-Copenhagen in terms of national policy. Now, I leave space for discussion afterwards, so I'll cover only a few of the many points one could make about this. Let me just mention 3 or 4 core points. Basically, we need a new politics, and this has to be driven by a range of components. First, we must develop a politics of the long term. This is really crucial. When you're confronting climate change, or indeed you're confronting issues of energy, it's no good taking short-term decisions. You're talking about a 20 or 30-year cycle. You're talking of planning ahead for the future, and you're talking about a systematic and sustained policy. If there is not systematic and sustained policy to reduce emissions, we are effectively dead in the water so far as controlling greenhouse gases are concerned. There's an important convergence here, I think, which you should recognize between recovering from the financial crisis and the prerogatives of producing long-term policy for climate change. Over the past 20 or 30 years, we had a period of deregulation in which people thought that markets could drive decisions. We know that that was, in some respects, a disaster. and we know we have to have a different approach. What it has to involve is a kind of collaboration, really, between government and markets. And the role of government is going to be crucial in this. But that collaboration is not going to be easy. You can't simply have a return to traditional planning. That is obvious. It never worked in the 1970s. We're going to have quite sophisticated rethinking. I offer you an example of this from the era of insurance. We know that we're going to have to adapt to climate change. We know that areas like the Caribbean, where you already have violent weather, hurricanes every year in the Caribbean area, people there are going to suffer far more than they do even at the moment. How are we going to protect poorer people? How are we going to protect poorer people in Bangladesh from the consequences of more extreme weather, which will come anyway, regardless of what we do now? Well, we have to find some way of insuring against loss of property and the consequences of weather events. Well, we know from Hurricane Katrina that even the richest state in the world can't provide too much protection for its citizens. So therefore, the private insurance industry is going to have to supply a great deal of capital to protect people. And we have to ask how this can be used to protect poorer people. Well, I see this as a kind of model for the future, because there are amazingly interesting things going on in quite a few countries across the world about this, which is like a kind of connection between low-tech and high-tech. If you look at Bangladesh, for example, or the Caribbean, I'll just take Bangladesh for to keep it fairly short. In Bangladesh, you have a lot of low-level initiatives being made to help prepare to adapt to more extreme weather. For example, in Bangladesh, they've invented floating gardens. And floating gardens, you can keep agriculture going even when flooding is quite intense. And they're using local kinship groups as a way of providing mobilization of this sort. However, satellite technology and weather tracking has now improved quite dramatically over the last few years, and we can predict the path of violent weather much more effectively than we could in the past. What makes the damage from a hurricane or a violent weather event is not simply the violence of the weather, but the path which the storm follows. We can now predict the path of a storm much more accurately than the past. So on the basis of bringing these two things together, you've now got insurance companies offering long-term insurance to large numbers of poorer people in these areas, which will, at least to some degree, protect them for the future. So one of my arguments in all this is there's too much emphasis simply on technology in what people are saying about climate change now. Of course, we need renewable energy and so forth, but social innovation, political innovation, economic innovation, innovation in the area of international relations is going to be every bit as important in preparing for this disturbing world which we've created by our own history. Second, crucially to the politics of climate change, we have to find some way of limiting political polarization around climate change. I think everyone sitting here has a responsibility for and can make a contribution to this. To me, climate change is not a left-right issue. I see no sense, really, in which it is a left-right issue. Climate change is a problem which threatens everybody. You therefore need agreement from many different sectors of the population, of citizens, to support climate change policy. It should transcend left-right divisions. Against that backdrop, look what has happened in the United States, as I mentioned earlier, where climate change has become polarized, so that by and large, most Republicans are climate change skeptics nowadays. They hold that climate change is not real. They therefore are hostile to any policies for dealing with climate change, and that has produced the situation which I described earlier. In other industrial countries, well, the same thing is happening in Australia, for anyone who's following Australian politics, where you're getting there a pretty radical polarization between left and right. We need to try to block this in the other industrial countries and find policies of sustaining consensus. I think in this country, we're actually doing pretty well because the climate change bill, which is quite a radical bill, and the energy bill, which is also quite a radical bill, both received cross-party consensus in both houses of parliament, were supported by Labour, by the Tories, and by the Lib Dems as well, and were in fact radicalised during the passage through parliament. But it's very important that we hold the line on this. And I think people on the left, like me, have an historic responsibility in the sense in which we should no longer say, excuse me, that green is the new red. If you say that green is the new red, you thereby put off people on the political right and certainly don't want to accept such a sentiment. And anyway, being green has nothing to do with being red, in my view. It is a transcendent issue for politics. So we have to hope that, let's assume the Tories do win the next election, that they will sustain Labour policy of a long-term framework for transforming the energy system and reducing emissions. But there are reasons to be worried here too, because there is a kind of convergence occurring between the political right and climate change scepticism, which is having a big effect on public opinion. You may have followed the statistics which show that proportion of people who believe that climate change is real, dangerous, and produced by human activity has dropped in this country since Copenhagen, has dropped substantially in the United States, even before Copenhagen, and has also, this has happened in quite a few countries across the world. So you are getting a sort of political polarization which is quite dangerous. I looked at the the top 10 Tory blogs, and that's also a bit worrying because of the top 10 Tory blogs, every single blogger is a climate change skeptic. So therefore, there could be substantial tensions within a Tory government, assuming that a Tory government does come to power, which I don't assume as an inevitability, but could possibly happen. See, you know, it's up. You cannot get sustained climate change policy if a left of centre government introduced policies which are simply abandoned by an incoming right of centre government. Here, you know, I think every citizen, and I hope everyone here will recognise their own responsibilities, that is, you have to keep the pressure on the politicians. You have to keep the pressure going to ensure that there is stability of policy and that the radical policies that will be needed to reduce emissions are sustained across changes of government. There's a lot more could be said about that, but that situation is quite disturbingly volatile in the wake of the attacks of the sceptics after Copenhagen. Third, however, it's not right to say that one should just be pessimistic in the light of what has happened over the past couple of months. Enormous changes will happen, I think, especially in the energy systems of countries across the world. They won't necessarily be driven by climate change considerations, but they're likely to have a substantial impact upon global greenhouse gas emissions. If you look across the world, many governments now are worried about energy security. They're right to be worried about energy security. Energy security is a key aspect of sustainability. I don't know how many people here followed the peak oil discussion, which Richard Branson and other industrialists were involved in 2 or 3 days ago. But it's remarkable how much change there's been in the position of industrial leaders on this. The idea of peak oil, in other words, that we're reaching the plateau of the amount of oil we can produce in the world used to be an unorthodox position, but now it's become basically an orthodox one. Many, many people think that we're quite close to the period of peak oil. Many governments think this. Therefore, quite rightly, they're introducing alternative strategies. And there is considerable source of encouragement here. Look at what China is doing, for example. Complete myth to suppose that China is some way miles behind the industrial countries and has to be dragged along behind them. China has got a radical plan for introducing renewable energy. Its targets for renewable energy sources are exactly the same as those of the European Union. China has been closing down many of its older coal-fired power stations. You shouldn't simply accept the thing that often appears in the press that one or two coal-fired power stations built in China every week. It's actually a very mixed picture in China. The Chinese leadership sees the need for a radical shift in energy policy, much higher proportion of renewable energy, whether one likes it or not, a much higher proportion of energy delivered by nuclear power. Exactly the same position is now taken by the Indian government, and India also has extensive plans for introducing renewable energy. These changes, I think, will become real. I think that we're at the edge of a big transformation in world energy systems, and a good deal of this could be very positive. To my mind, however, the only large developing country which is driven by a kind of appropriate mix of energy security considerations and climate change considerations is Brazil. The Brazilian leadership, I think, does get both sides of the picture and recognizes the drastic consequences which climate change could produce. I'm not sure that either the Indian leadership or Chinese leadership is as motivated by this as they could and should be, but nevertheless, I think pretty dramatic transformations will occur, and they could quite substantially affect global greenhouse emissions. But I think in the wake of Copenhagen, we see something else. That is, if you look at a country like America, you look at a country like India, one can't any longer be satisfied just by federal government, national government policy. It's our obligation, I think, to encourage a great deal of bubble up from bottom levels of cities, of regions, of localities. It's up to us to try to ensure that NGOs and other groups have a crucial role in affecting climate change policy, that it isn't just left to the leaders of nations. And I think if you look at some of the key nations involved, this is actually happening. And the United States is the key case in many ways, I think. What is happening in the US? Well, you're only going to get weak federal climate change policy because President Obama is never going to get any kind of radical climate change act through Congress. However, President Obama is going to be a radical on clean energy. There are going to be very large-scale plans for a transformation of the American energy system, which probably can get through Congress, so he's going to try and do that. But the fact of the matter is the United States is a very diverse country. So all the time that the Bush administration was in denial about climate change, there were many things going on in the US at a state level, at a local level, at a city level. Some 360 cities in America got together to promote active climate change policy during the Bush period. Plenty of localities have their own transition plans to a low-carbon economy. The Terminator, Governor Schwarzenegger, has started this R20 group, which is getting together people from cities all over the world to work below the level of the nation and above the level of the nation. This is crucial, I think, for the future. This is where energy must come from, And this is why I'm so pleased that you've all come to this forum today, because everyone here can be in the vanguard, I think, of these transformations. In conclusion, I would like to propose to you that we're on the cusp of one of the biggest changes in world history. That industrial civilization is now running up against its limits. We've come to the end of a certain period of history. A new kind of economy, a low-carbon economy, will emerge. A new kind of society and a new kind of politics will probably be part and parcel of these changes. In order to achieve this, I think we need, as it were, a mixture of utopianism and realism. And I use this term utopian realism to describe it. We need a dash of utopian thinking, because we need to think beyond the world in which we live now. We need to think how things could be different. We need to think, for example, what lies beyond a cheap energy, car-driven, restlessly expanding industrial civilization, which cannot be sustained even in the medium term. What lies beyond it on a local level? What lies beyond it on a national level, on a transnational level? But at the same time, this has to be grounded in realism, because climate change is a real and pressing issue. I think it's important to stress how different climate change is from issues like global poverty. Global poverty is very bad, right? So if you have global poverty in 2050, like it is today, not very good for the world. But in the case of climate change, it's quite different, because the emissions are going into the air all the time and they're accumulating there. So by 2050, it won't be just that climate change is still bad, it's going to be dramatically different in terms of its consequences for us. That's why we must have a grounding in realism. We must look for realistic strategies, not just utopian ones. And I do think that all around us, we do see, you know, utopian experimentation. If you look at, for example, the town of Bremen in Germany, they've more or less completely transformed their transportation system. They've got an integrated transportation system where people can use bikes, can walk, can use public transport, make marginal use of the motor car. And as a result, car use has dropped dramatically. Local emissions have dropped dramatically. Most people here will be aware of the Transition Towns movement, to which some towns in the UK belong, where people are already doing something on the ground to create a different kind of society. But what is happening locally, I think, will also happen more globally, because having been to India and China and talked to people in many different contexts there, you see parallel things going on there as well. Because what is surely evident is that China and India simply cannot track the process of development which Western countries have followed for much longer. It'll simply be too dangerous. So in the West, we have to have a critique of GDP as the indicator of welfare. We have to look beyond a simple growth model for our economies. If anyone's interested in this, the Sustainability Development Commission here, led by a guy called Tim Jackson, just produced a book called Prosperity Without Growth, Prosperity Without Growth, which is quite a radical tract for our times, which tries to disentangle welfare from growth. In the industrial countries, we know that economic growth beyond a certain level does not increase welfare. In some part, it subverts welfare. People's measures of satisfaction or happiness do not grow with increasing GDP. We cannot any longer live in a world where GDP is simply the measure of welfare, and we have to get political leaders to actually take action on this. Some people here will know the report that was produced by President Sarkozy in France by a range of prominent economists, including Joe Stiglitz, which provides other indices of welfare, which we have to try to tailor to economic development. If it's crucial for us, it's even more crucial for China and India. Those countries, I think, are likely going to follow a kind of mixture of low-tech and high-tech of the sort that I described earlier. And we want to encourage this, I think. Why, if you go to an Indian community, which is fairly robust, why do you want that to be dismembered by supermarkets being built outside of the towns, which undermine community, which undermine the local food industry, which have destructive as well as constructive effects? Well, I don't think you necessarily do. Therefore, it seems to me entirely cogent and possible to create alternative models of development, which will certainly be compatible with the creation of wealth, but will also have a decisive impact on greenhouse gas emissions at the same time. I don't think that is wholly utopian. If I can give you another example of utopian realism, I think we should lead a movement to stop any industrial country building a further coal-fired power station. I don't think it's enough to build coal-fired power stations and say that CCS will come along and make those coal-fired power stations less destructive in terms of the impact. Coal is the big worry for us, right? I mean, I don't know how far you appreciate this, but coal is the main division, really, between the climate change skeptics and the scientific opinion on climate change. There is plenty of coal. There seems to be plenty of coal in the world. Oil is on the point of not running out, but peaking. Gas at some point is likely to peak too. The great worry is that the world will not only continue to build coal-fired power stations, but will turn back more and more to coal. If you're a climate change skeptic, it doesn't matter if the world turns back towards coal. For anyone who, like me, who thinks that the science is very robust and that climate change is indeed very dangerous, we must put a block on the expansion of coal-fired production of energy. And when James Hansen says that coal-fired power stations are engines of death, it sounds like an extreme statement, but it isn't, I think. Coal-fired power stations are spewing out greenhouse gases in a way which is simply, you know, having one of the most radical effects on the atmosphere. I didn't see why we couldn't push towards a concordat whereby the industrial countries do agree to put a moratorium on the building of coal-fired power stations, and then they see what they do. After that, if you draw a line under them, countries can find ways. It isn't that difficult of developing alternative energy systems. Anyway, it's this mixture of utopianism and realism which I feel we need. And it's for this reason, you know, I think we're not at the end of history, that we're at the beginning of history, a new history, where I think, in spite of what's happened, one can have a positive and optimistic attitude towards change. There are many, many problems which face us. Nevertheless, I don't feel downcast by the position which we're in, and especially if we can develop enough energy to confront these problems. You might remember that there was a famous, I don't know how many people here are social scientists, but there was a famous American social scientist called Francis Fukuyama, who about 20 years ago said we're at the end of history because we don't know of any society beyond the one we've got now, a mixture of markets, industrial production, democracy. Well, I mean, there must be, and there will be, a form of society beyond the one we've got now, because we are living in unsustainable civilization. It's not only climate change that is the index of that unsustainability. We are living in an unsustainable civilization, which cannot offer you, the audience, the same kind of patterns of development that it offered people of my generation. Therefore, we're at the beginning of something new, I think, and rather than speaking of the end of history, we should speak really of the end of history, and we should look for a radical social, political, economic, as well as technological inventiveness in order to help us achieve this. Thank you for your attention.